Jeff Meyer. He's super awesome, and he's a topology wizard. So let's welcome Jeff.
Thank you. I don't know how fitting that is, but... So today I wanted to talk to you a little bit about knots and surfaces that we associate to knots, ribbon surfaces, slice disks, ciphered surfaces, and hopefully we could talk a little bit at the end about the knot concordance group, which is a way of giving a group structure to the set of all knots. So first off, how many people are familiar with the definition of a manifold? Just by a show of hands. Okay, so about half of you. So we'll just quickly we'll talk about that and then we'll move on. Okay. So first thing I want to talk about, we'll call part one knots and surfaces. Okay, so what we're going to be considering today is a certain type of manifolds. So we're going to be considering compact, orientable, connected manifolds. So for those of you that don't know, a manifold is a topological space, which means it's a set together with a collection of open sets. And it's a particularly nice one. So we want it to be Hausdorff and second countable, which are just topological properties. If you've never taken a topology class, it's really okay because you'll know what a manifold is sort of when I show you. What do all these words mean? Well, compact is also a topological property, so we won't worry about that too much. Connected means what you think it should mean, that it's actually connected. And orientable means that you can't travel around a loop in your manifold and return to where you started as your mirror image. So let's look at an example of this. So typical thing that we're going to be interested in looking at will look something like this. So what you're looking at is the surface of a donut which has been punctured. Oh, and I didn't say the main thing about a topological space. So locally, a manifold is homeomorphic to an open subset of, let's say, the upper half space Rn. So what does that look like in this example? Well, everywhere in this manifold here, we should be able to see a local homeomorphism to the upper half space R2. So this is an example of a two-manifold or a surface. So if we take a point here in the interior, then we can find an open set around it that's going to get mapped homeomorphically onto some point and some open set in R2+. So if this is our manifold X, this is R2+. And the same thing goes for boundary points. Okay, so if we have some point Q on the boundary, then there's this sort of open set that looks like a half open set, and that gets mapped homeomorphically by some other homeomorphism to this subset of R2n. So the basic way to think about a manifold is it's just a really nice space that you can travel through, and everywhere you are, it looks like you're in some Euclidean space. So for example, we're in a three-manifold right now. Okay, in a local area of where we are, it looks like you can move in three directions. Now, who's to say what the global characteristic of this space is, but at least locally it looks like what we'd expect it to look like. Okay, so maybe I'll just make one more comment on orientability. So I said something about being able to travel in this space. So, for example, could we travel through three-dimensional space and walk off in some direction or even, you know, fly off in some direction, come back to where we were, but return sort of as the mirror image of ourselves, right? With east and west maybe flipped. And so this can happen in certain types of manifolds. So an example, you know, the simplest example of this happening in a manifold is probably the Möbius band. So one thing you can check is that if you have an ant on this Möbius band, so he's flat, and it kind of makes you wonder where their legs attach. I assume they attach to this piece. But so the question is, if he walks around this space in a path and returns to where he is he going to look the same as he looked before? Well, if he's a symmetric ant, he will. But let's make him asymmetrical. So let's pretend that it's a pirate ant. And what you can check, is that when he comes back around, he will be exactly what he would look like if he were looking in the mirror. Okay. And it's simply because he would have, you know, flipped upside down. So we won't consider manifolds that do this. That's an example of a non-orientable manifold because it contains such a loop. Okay, so our manifolds won't contain these loops. Another way to think about an orientable manifold is that there's two sides to it. So for example, a disk, a flat disk, there's an upside and a downside. You could color each side different colors. With this Mobius band, it only has one side. Okay, if you start on the outside, you go around and then you end up on the inside. Okay. Any questions about what it means for a space to be a manifold? There's more details that I'm suppressing, obviously, but you know the general idea is it's just a space that looks like a Rn, Euclidean space. Everyone's familiar with Euclidean space, right? Rn? Okay. All right. Okay, so one thing that we can sort of notice from these two examples, both of these examples are two-dimensional manifolds with a boundary component. Okay? And one thing you notice about the boundary component is it itself is a manifold. Okay, so the boundary here is a manifold. Oh, should have picked a different color. The boundary here is actually a manifold also. It's a single. Both of these manifolds, both of the boundaries are circles. Okay. So the fact is that the boundary of an n manifold, an n-dimensional manifold, is an n minus one dimensional manifold. Okay. So what you know, what low-dimensional topologists are particularly interested in doing is studying manifolds. Okay. We mainly study three manifolds and four manifolds. And the relationship there is that a four-manifold with boundary has as its boundary a three-manifold. And so there's this important connection. And the way we tend to study three- and four-manifolds is by studying one- and two-manifolds that live inside them. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about one-manifolds, which will essentially be knots, and two-manifolds, which will be surfaces. And we use these things to study three- and four-dimensional manifolds. And that's low-dimensional topology in a nutshell, I guess. Okay, so let's start by recalling a classification of surfaces. Okay, so some of you have seen this before. So let's say, here's a list of, I didn't tell you what closed means. Of closed, and of course we're always going to be connected and orientable closed surfaces. And we're always going to be compact. So what closed means is basically has no boundary. So closed means compact and with no boundary. No boundary. Okay, so here's a list of closed surfaces. So you can imagine what these things sort of look like. They look like they're just spaces where at every point, if you were a small ant, you would look like you were on a flat tabletop. Okay? So the simplest example is a sphere. Okay, the surface of the Earth is a two-manifold. And then we actually get a complete list of the rest of the two-manifolds by just putting holes in the sphere in this way. And so on. So we have this countable list of closed surfaces. Okay, and you can prove in a variety of ways that this is a complete list of closed, connected, orientable surfaces. Okay? And to each of these surfaces, we can associate a number that sort of tells them apart. And this number is called the genus. Okay, so the genus of the sphere is 0, the torus is 1, the double torus is 2, the triple torus is 3, and so on. Okay, and essentially it's just counting the number of holes. So it's nothing too complicated. So what I want to do now is I want to give another description of these same surfaces, probably one that fewer people are familiar with. And that's that we can think of another set where first we just take a disk, then for the next piece, we take a disk and we attach two bands to it. And then for the, so. And then for the third piece, we take a disk and we attach two pairs of two bands. and so on. Okay? And then, for each of these spaces, we make a key observation, which is that these are two manifolds with boundary, and their boundary is actually a connected one manifold. Okay? And so, that raises the question, how many connected closed one manifolds are there? And there's actually only one. So we see that in each case, the boundary is just a circle. And I won't do that one, but you get the point, right? And this has to do with the fact, this, you know, has to do with the way we attach these bands. The fact that they sort of are linked with each other in this way ensures that, you know, you go around and come back out the way you want to. Well, so the natural thing to do is, now, we glue on a disk. We glue on a disk to each of these surfaces. Right, the disk, what's a disk look like? Well, I already drew one, but let's draw another one. It's got a circle boundary component. Sorry about that. So we can take this disk and we can glue it along the circle boundary component. And the fact is that these two lists are the same. So in particular, if I take two disks and I glue them along their boundary, I ought to get a sphere. And that's exactly what I get. If I take two disks and I glue them along their boundary, I get a sphere. Okay? So this disk union this disk gives me my sphere. This disk union this funny looking thing, it will actually give me a torus. So that's a good exercise. So you can show that this picture, I'll redraw it just for fun, is the same as this picture. Okay? You can make them look the same. All right, so this is, you know, this is what surfaces look like, up to homeomorphism, okay? So every surface is homeomorphic to one of these things. Any questions so far? Okay. All right. I guess the only thing that I sort of mentioned, but maybe I'll write it down. Another fact the only closed one manifold is the circle, which we write as S1, right? Which just looks like this. Oop. That's the only way you can have a one manifold that has no boundary and is compact. Okay. The rest of the one manifolds aren't very hard to describe either. You have the interval and you have the real line. This one's not compact, the real line is not compact, and the interval has boundary. And in terms of connected one manifolds, that's the whole list. So what we have on the board is we understand one manifolds and two manifolds completely up to homeomorphism. So what we want to do for the rest of the talk is we want to look at how we can make this a little bit more interesting. Okay. So the first thing we want to do is we want to talk about knots. So what is a knot? It's an embedding phi of the circle into the three sphere. Okay. So maybe there's a couple things I should explain here. What's the three sphere? Okay. Well, let's back up and let's think about what smaller spheres are. Okay. So one way to think about a circle is that we can take R, we can take the line, and we can union a point at infinity. Okay. So if you take the line and then you add in the point at infinity, then you've essentially closed it up into a circle. So traveling off in this direction, eventually you'll get to a point at infinity, but that's the same point you get to if you travel in this direction. So you've formed the circle by taking the line and unioning it with infinity. And in another way to see this is if you remove a point from the circle, then what you really have is a real line that's sort of curled up on itself and approaches this missing point. Okay. We can do the same thing with R2. Take the plane and add in a point at infinity here. So this is the same sort of mental exercise, right? Think of the plane as an infinite blanket, okay, which goes off to infinity in all directions. And what we're going to do is we're just going to draw all the ends of the blanket up to a single point. And we're going to add that point into the space. Well, what's that going to look like? Well, when we draw the blanket up to a single point, it's going to look like a sphere with a point missing, and then we just add in that point at infinity. So we get the sphere. So we can think of the circle, so this is the circle, which is the one sphere, and the sphere, which is the two sphere, as the real line and the real plane union a point at infinity. Well, the same thing works for S3. So S3 is R3 union a point at infinity. Okay. So we're in R3, let's suppose. And we want to add a point at infinity. So basically what that means is if we travel off in any direction, we'll end up at the same point. Okay. So what this means for us is S3 is basically a lot like R3, especially if we're only looking at a piece of it. Okay. So as far as we're concerned, this room that we're in could be a portion of S3 or R3 equally well. Okay. So when I say that a knot is an embedding of the circle into S3, I really mean it's an embedding of the circle into R3, and then maybe we're thinking about infinity a little differently. And, okay, well, we should also understand what embedding means. This just means that it's a smooth, injective map into the space. Which, you know, there's some technicalities there to work out, but this is probably not the right place to talk too much about that. Instead, let's just draw some examples, okay? So all of these things are going to be circles. But what's going to be different is the way that they sit in three-dimensional space. So, you know, the first thing we can do is we can just map it in sort of a silly way, and we get what's called the unknot, okay? But then there are lots of more interesting things we can do. We can map it in this way and get, this is the left-handed trefoil. Okay, for example. So this thing, it's really just a circle, but now it's constrained by the way it sits in three-dimensional space. Okay. And we can keep going. I could probably draw a lot more of these than you'd ever care to look at, but this is a nice one. This is the figure eight. And maybe we'll stop there for now. Maybe we'll find some more later. So these are, you know, these are probably the three most common knots. Okay. This is, you know, in some sense, this is the only three-crossing knot, and this is the only four-crossing knot. So after that, they have to have more and more crossings. Okay, let's see how we're doing. Great. Any questions about what a knot is? Okay. So, I mean, all this, you know, all these technicalities about manifolds and embeddings and spaces and stuff, a knot is really just a circle drawn in three space. Okay. It's exactly what you would think if you took a piece of rope, put some tangles in it, and then glued the ends together. No, no, we don't allow that. Yeah, that's a good question. Let's keep it finite crossings. In fact, let's keep it four for now. The other thing is we want to be able to move our knots around. Okay, so for example, you know, we want this to be the same as that, right? And we want this to be the same as maybe that. So we don't want to just consider these embeddings as rigid objects that can't move. We want to consider them as things that we can sort of stretch and move and flip around. The only rule is that we can't break it and we can't pass a strand through itself. Okay. So technically, this is called ambient isotopy. But we won't worry too much about that for now. What that really means is we can just move the knots around exactly like we would want to. Okay, so here's a bunch of interesting embeddings of knots into three space. We can do the same things with surfaces. So here's some interesting embeddings of surfaces with boundary. Okay. So I'll work mostly with this guy, the torus, a punctured torus. So let's call this guy a punctured torus. And I mean, the reason we want to call it that is because that's what it's this guy, right? It's a torus where we've sort of removed a disk, an open disk. Okay, so let's look at some interesting embeddings of this guy. Well, what we can do is we can take a band and we can change the band by a homeomorphism. Okay, so that means that we can add an even number of twists to any of the bands. So one guy that we can get is this. Okay. So this is clearly still homeomorphic to a torus because it's just a disk with two bands attached. All that's changed is the way we twisted the bands before we attached them. Up to homeomorphism, this is no different. But in terms of an embedding in three-dimensional space, it is different. Because you can't change that to this by just sort of moving it around. You have to actually cut the band and untwist it, which is a homeomorphism but not an ambient isotopy. Okay, so these guys are different in terms of being embedded in three-space. Okay. And so maybe I'll give another example or two. This guy will feature later.
In that example, were you just looking at the circle?
This one?
Were you just looking at the circle?
No, that's a good point. Let me make that clear. This is actually an embedding of the surface. Is it unknotted as a circle? It shouldn't be. Even as a circle, it's an interesting embedding, but I'm really thinking of it as an embedding up as a surface. Is that your question? Yeah. But that's the right observation to make, which is that this is an embedding of a surface, but you'll notice the boundary of the surface is embedded as a knot. Okay. So the boundary of these surfaces, are knots. They're embeddings of the circle into three space. So let me just draw one more. I actually forget which way this one goes, but okay, so there's one. Once again with the surface shaded. And then, you know, maybe just for fun I'll draw a knot that I'm interested in. So we can also twist the bands together like this, right? Not only can we add twists to the bands, but we can make the bands sort of wrap around each other. And if we're feeling really adventurous, we can even, you know, tie knots in the bands. Okay. So see, what we have here is a torus, or a punctured torus, an embedding of a punctured torus, and its boundary is some highly non-trivial knot, right? You know, I want to shade it, but I don't think I will. This is for the sake of time. Okay, good. So we can see from this that we can get lots of knots by embedding these surfaces with boundary. And a question is, does every knot bound an orientable surface like these ones? And the answer is yes. So, question. Does every knot in S3 bound an orientable surface? And the answer is a theorem due to Seifert from 1934, I think. And the theorem is that the answer is yes. Okay, that indeed every knot does bound an orientable surface. And Seifert gave a nice way of doing this. And so maybe I'll just walk through the construction really quick, give an example. So let's take this knot. This is another nice knot we can add to our family. This knot is called the stevedore knot, stevedore's knot. And, okay, so how does Seifert's algorithm work? Well, we orient the knot. Doesn't really matter how we do it, but we just give it a direction. So this is easy to do. You just draw arrows all over your knot in a consistent way. And then what we do is we start somewhere on the knot and we follow the edge of the knot around. But when we reach a crossing, we change strands in the direction of the orientation. Okay, so what's that look like? If I start off here, then when I reach this crossing, I'm going to jump strands and go this way, because that's the orientation of the other crossing. And here I'm going to turn left. And here I'm going to turn right. And here I'm going to go this way. Okay. So what I do is I trace out a circle. All right. It's a curve, a closed curve in the plane. And we do the same thing with all the other parts of the knot. So this is going to give me a little circle like that. This is going to give me a circle like that and like that. And this is going to give me a circle like that. So these are called Seifert circuits. And so once you give a knot an orientation like this, you can do this. And so the way we see the surface is that each of these circles is going to be the boundary of a disk. Okay, so let's see that. So first we get a disk. So this big one that I did first is sort of this disk down here. And then we've got a smaller disk sitting on top of it. And if we wanted to sort of color code the surface, it sort of wraps up like that. And then these each are little disks. It look like that. Okay? And you can see now, okay, so now we've got these different disks, and to get the surface that we wanted, we just add singly twisted bands in between each disk. So I add in a little band here that twists and twists. So the way I've colored this is it's yellow if the disk has flipped over. Okay? And what I've drawn there is an orientable surface whose boundary is the knot. So if you can see it, it's like this green thing is a disk, and then there's a band here that twists four times. And then there's a band here that comes up over the top and goes from this side of the green disk to the other side of the green disk. Can you guys see that? Okay, so this is Seifert's algorithm, and you can prove that it works for any knot. Okay, so knots do bound surfaces. Okay, well, knots bound surfaces, and to each surface, we can associate a number, a genus. So this actually allows us to build a knot invariant. So the definition is the genus of a knot. So we know what the genus of a surface is. It's just how many holes are in it. The genus of a knot is the minimum genus of all surfaces, all orientable surfaces. Bounded by the knot. Okay? So we know that a knot bounds at least one surface. Let's say it bounds many, many surfaces. We look at all those surfaces, and we find the one whose genus is the lowest. And we call that the genus of the knot. Okay?
So like if that is genus 0, that's the unknot.
Good. That's what I was going to write next. So fact. So we write this the genus of K. If the genus of K equals 0, K is the unknot. That's exactly right. The unknot is the only knot that bounds a disk in the 3-sphere. Okay, that's another way to say that. I'll rewrite it because it's something I want to emphasize. Hey, only the unknot bounds a disk in S3. Okay. So, what else do we know? Does anyone know what the genus of this surface is? It's not a disk. Yeah? Nope. So, come back to our surfaces, right? We should be thinking of this surface as a disk with some number of bands attached. Okay, so that's a disk with how many bands attached to it? Two bands, one pair of bands, right? So you can actually, this is actually this. Those are the same. If you just sort of flip it around a little bit and do a little move. So it's this green disk with a band attached here and a band attached here. So it's genus 1. Okay, so for example, we see the genus of the stevedore's knot is 1. Right? And the reason we see that is because we know that it can't be larger than 1, because here we have a genus 1 surface, and we know it can't be 0 because it's not the unknot. I guess technically we don't know it's the unknot, but it is. Technically we don't know that it's not the unknot, but it is. So that's an example of a genus 1 knot. And these knots are both genus 1 also. Using Seifert's algorithm, you can come up with a genus 1 surface spanned by these knots. Just orient them, build the Seifert surfaces, and then fix everything together. Yes?
Doesn't the unknot bound the genus 1 surface as well?
Sure. Yeah, this is a picture of the unknot bounding a genus 1 surface.
So wouldn't that be... Oh, I see. Okay.
But we take the minimum over all it bounds. So here's 3 pictures of the unknot. Right? It bounds a genus 2 surface, a genus 1 surface, and a genus 0 surface. The minimum is 0. That's a good point. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So, this is the problem that I really want to talk about for the rest of the talk is, knots don't bound disks in the 3-sphere. So that's not actually true, what I just said. Knots don't bound embedded disks. Okay, these surfaces that we were dealing with were all embedded, which means they don't intersect themselves. What we want to do now is we want to relax that idea. We want to allow surfaces to intersect themselves, but only in special ways. Okay, so let me introduce a definition. A knot is called ribbon. Okay, it's a ribbon knot if it bounds an immersed disk. So there's a fancy word. Immersed just means that we've mapped the disk in and it might intersect itself now. But it's been sort of smoothly mapped in. So it doesn't do really weird things. Now it just might intersect itself. But we want to control these intersection points. So a knot is called ribbon if it bounds in an immersed disk whose self-intersections look like this. So, okay, we've got this disk. It sort of runs all through space, and it's going to intersect itself. What's that intersection going to look like? It's going to look like this. Let me get my colors back. So here it comes down through here like this. And it's going to shoot out the bottom. Okay, so here, this disk is not embedded. It's sort of crashing through itself, but it's doing so in a really nice way. Okay, it's doing so in a way that it only intersects itself in its interior. It's not something like this. Now, this is the type of thing we don't want. Oops, let me get my flat edge back. We don't want some picture like this, where it sort of intersects in a weird way. We want it to just come through the interior of the disk in a ribbon-like way. Okay? Can everyone see why it's called ribbon? Okay. So there's a lot of technicalities in this talk, but hopefully, on the very bottom of everything, things are rather intuitive. So this is exactly what we mean by a ribbon knot. So do these things exist? Whenever you make a definition, you have to then explain to people that it was worth making. Okay, and then I'd color it. Okay, so there's a ribbon knot. So the white part, the boundary of this disk, so that's a disk. Do you believe that? Does it look like a disk? I mean, you can sort of like, imagine it, I don't know. The boundary is a knot, and it's not a trivial knot. What knot is it? I think it's this knot, actually. I think it's the stevedore's knot. So it's a picture of the stevedore's knot bounding a ribbon disc. And I'll do one more picture because I think it's a nice one. You guys would tell me if you didn't think it looked like. Okay, so here's another nice picture. I'm under the assumption that my pictures are going to make sense, because otherwise this is going to be a pretty bad talk. Can you guys see the disc there? Okay, so it's absolutely not. So it starts here, and then, you know, it starts off, and then it just goes through here, it twists, and then it comes through back to there. So you can imagine, making this out of a disc, you know. Take your disc, stretchy, and, you know, pull it out, put three twists in it, that's the bottom part, and then pass sort of in turn the ends through each other. Yeah. Okay, so there's two ribbon discs. Okay. So ribbon knots, these are ribbon knots, and they exist, because I just drew some, but not all knots are ribbon knots. So maybe we'll just put that here. Okay. For example, the trefoil knots in the figure eight are not ribbon knots. Okay. Good. Okay, so that's sort of the first part of the talk. It's knots and surfaces that they bound in the three sphere. Any questions? Okay. What happened to the eraser? Oh, I took it over here. All right. So the next thing I want to talk about is something that's near and dear to my heart, which is slice knots. Okay, so what is a slice knot? I see. Okay, before I get to the definition of a slice knot. Okay, so the first thing I want to mention is that we have a way of combining two knots together. If I have two knots that look like this, we can combine them together. So let's say for now that they're oriented. We can combine them together by removing a small piece of each one. Okay? So what is this sort of going to look like? We're going to take sort of a piece like this and delete it, and then we're going to join them together like this. So the result is something like that. Okay, and this is called the connect sum. So this is, if this is K1, this is K2, this is the connect sum, K1, connect sum, K2. Okay. So a fact about connect sums that's actually fun to prove, although maybe a little challenging, but not too bad, is that if you, the genus of the connect sum of two knots is just the sum of its genuses. Okay. So the connect sum operation, the way it works, we take two knots and we just remove a little segment of each and then band them together. So essentially what I've done is I've just made a little band in between the knots. You can see it here. And this is a way of taking old knots and getting new ones. Okay. So a couple of remarks about this. What do you think would happen if I did the connect sum with the unknot?
Nothing.
Nothing would happen, right? You know, we would take a band, but then we could sort of push the rest of the unknot into the old knot. So the first observation is that K connect sum U is K. Okay? And the second observation is that K connect sum J is the same as J connect sum K. Okay, I could just sort of flip this picture around and then the order would be reversed. There's no real order, in fact. You know, any order that we see in this operation is pretty artificial. So the operation is commutative. Okay. This begs the question. So I haven't introduced the notation, but let's let K be the set of knots up to ambient isotopy, right? So here's a question. Is this set, together with this binary operation connect sum, a group? Okay. So what is a group? It's just a set with a binary operation that has to have a couple of rules. All right, what are some of the rules?
Associativity.
Associativity. Okay, check. Inverses. Okay, what else? Identity. We have an identity element. Has to be closed. We get a new knot when we do this, so it's closed. It's associative. It's well-defined if we account for ambient isotopy. But there aren't any inverses. Okay? So the answer is no. There's no knot J that we can connect some with K to get the unknot. Right? And here's one reason why. Because the genus is going to add up. Right? So we would have to have some number that's greater than 0, maybe 2, plus another number that's greater than 0, maybe 1, equals 0. Which, of course, is not going to happen. Okay? Since the genus adds, we see that we can never take two knots, connect some of them together, and then magically they fall apart into the unknot. Okay? So we don't have a group. Okay? So let's try to fix that. Okay. Before we fix that, let's make a quick observation. So we already saw that S1 is the boundary of a disk, right? D2. Well, in a similar way, S2 is the boundary of the 2-ball. Or what's that? The 3-ball. D3. Okay. So what about S3? Well, S3 is the boundary of the 4-dimensional ball. Okay. So one way to think of this is, well, you have to visualize R4, or maybe C2, right? C cross C. And S3 is just the unit sphere in that 4-dimensional space, and everything on the inside is the 4-ball. Okay, so we're going up to 4 dimensions now. And this is one of the reasons why it's helpful to choose our knots to live in S3 instead of R3. Because R3, well, I guess you can sort of think of R3 as bounding half of R4, but it's not as helpful. Okay, the 3-sphere is the boundary of the 4-ball. So what this allows us to do is think of our knot sitting in S3. Right. So here's our knot sitting in S3. We know K doesn't bound a disk in the 3-sphere, but maybe it bounds a disk that sort of has its boundary in the 3-sphere and then goes into the 4-ball down here. Okay. So we can think of the boundary of the disk living on the boundary of the 4-ball, but then the inside of the disk being down in the 4-ball, where there's a lot more room, right? There's 4 dimensions, so things can kind of shift out differently. So the definition is that a knot is slice if it bounds a disk D, inside the 4-ball, remember a knot K is living in S3, with the boundary of the disk being equal to the knot living in the 3-sphere. Okay, so it's exactly the picture I sort of schematically drew here. Okay, so this is what it means for a knot to be slice. Okay, so how are some ways that we can deal with the fourth dimension? Well, one way is with time or movies. Okay, so we can think of the fourth dimension as time. Sort of as we move into the 4-ball, you know, the deeper we go is the longer we've traveled. And we can draw sort of the time slices at each step.
Okay,
so...
Well,
let's look at how this can happen. So let me start with a knot here. So this is an example of something that's called a pretzel knot. And I'm going to draw a movie. So we start off with the pretzel knot, but then we sort of start moving it towards itself like this. So that's maybe the second step. And then after that, we actually let it meld together. Okay, this is something that we can do when we're working in four dimensions. And so we're going to get something like this. Right. So this would be, say, time... Well, we started off at time 0, and now we're at time 1 here. And this is time 2. We sort of do a little banding right here. Okay. And you can see the result here is something that looks like this, which is, of course, just two disks. So here's time 3, and here's times 4. And these are disks, so we could just cap them off with disks at the bottom. So this movie shows how this knot is actually bounding a disk in the four ball. So what would it look like? Well, we started off with this knot up here. It had those three strands. This was time 0. And then we just sort of start moving down. As we move down a little ways, we've just isotoped it. So we're at time 1. All we've done is sort of moved parts of the boundary of the disk closer to each other. But then at time 2, we do this banding. And what that does is it splits the disk into two pieces, which we can maybe draw like this. So at time 2, we have now split the single boundary component into two boundary components, and they both bound disks, but they're sort of tangled up. And then down at time 3, they're just twisted, and then at time 4, they're unknotted. So this is what's called a slice movie. It shows how the knot is bounding a disk down into the four ball. Okay. Are there any questions about that? Yeah.
Yeah, so you're bringing these two pieces together. Did it ever touch at this one point?
Yeah, there's sort of like a singularity that corresponds to the, you know, the critical point, the saddle critical point right here.
Yeah, so if there's a time in which it's just tangent, wouldn't that make it not a manifold at that point in time?
No, not quite. You know, it's always a manifold because what we're really describing is a saddle on the disk. The cross section is not a manifold. You're exactly right. The cross section is not a manifold, but that's okay. I mean, that's sort of like saying, you know, here's something. This is a manifold, but here's a cross section that's not a manifold. You know, like the tangent one. That's what you're saying, right? That's somewhere where you would have a trouble. But it is bounding sort of this smooth disk. So now that I've done this, it's easier to go backwards. Okay, so what do? We start with two disks, and then we just twist one up as we sort of move up towards the surface of the ball. We just put some twists in the disk. Then we run it through. We run them sort of through each other here. And then we do a little band move right here where we glue the disk together. So that's like going from this picture where we have two disks. Maybe they're twisted. But we have two disks. That goes to this picture. We've connected those disks with sort of like a little trough. Okay? That's the picture as we flow upwards. And what we end up with is the knot somehow bounding a disk. Okay? And this is hard to visualize because, you know, it's dealing with a disk that's knotted in four dimensions. I mean, sort of a very difficult thing to even think about. Okay. So that's what it means to be sliced. So how is this related to being a ribbon knot? Anybody want to venture a guess? It's a good question. Who said that? You did? Are they equivalent? Is ribbon and slice equivalent? That's a good question. We'll get to that in a second. There is one thing you can say. Let's take a look at these ribbon knots. They don't bound disks in the three sphere, right? We've been over that a couple times. But they are bounding disks that are immersed. Do you think there's any way that we could push those disks into the four ball and have them be actually embedded disks in the four ball? So the colors are actually a hint as to how we do that. That's exactly what we can do, right? Take this disk. Let's maybe work with Well, let's work with this one. Take this disk. It's sitting in S3. Just push it into the four ball. So think of the four balls sort of living, I don't know, in some direction. So we push the inside of the disk into the four ball. It still has intersections, right? Let's maybe highlight these. There's these intersections right here. Okay. So it's not embedded. But now we're in the four ball. We have an extra dimension, right? So right here, the disk, there's the yellow part of the disk and the red part of the disk, and they're hitting. We'll just push the yellow part of the disk farther into the four ball. And then they won't be intersecting anymore. So the extra dimension allows us to push the colors in at different depths. So if I push this disk into the four ball, I can push each color into a different depth. And then there's no intersection. They intersect in the three spatial components, but they don't intersect in the time depth. So the disk, these disks are actually embedded in the four ball. Okay. A little tricky to wrap your head around the first time you see it. Same thing here. All right, we can think of the blue part as being near the surface of the four ball, and the yellow part as being deeper. So when we run over this bit and the blue part, we're near the surface, and then we carry on, still near the surface, haven't intersected anything. Then now we're deeper. We come back to the same place we were in the three-dimensional directions, but now we're deeper in the four ball, so we don't intersect where we used to be. Okay, it's the same argument that goes into, some of you have seen this, the Klein bottle. Yeah. So what is the Klein bottle? It's where you take a cylinder and then you run one end through itself and attach it sort of oppositely to the other end. And it can't live in three-dimensional space without intersecting itself. But if we throw it into four-dimensional space, then we can just think of it exactly how it is, except as we get close to this intersection, we sort of blush. It's called blushing as we go around, which basically means we just dig a little bit deeper in the four ball to avoid intersecting where we used to be. Okay, it's the same sort of argument. So the resulting fact is, well, let's call it a theorem, is that ribbon knots are slice. Okay, we see that all we have to do is take the ribbon knot, give it a ribbon disk position, push it into the four ball, and then just push the ribbon singularities off each other, right? Where we have these nice intersections, we just push one farther in. That's why we wanted it to intersect in this nice way. We couldn't do that here, right? There's no way to get these to stop intersecting each other, even with four dimensions. But we can do it in these pictures. So ribbon knots are slice. But the famous conjecture, which is the slice-ribbon conjecture, is the question of whether the opposite is true. So the slice-ribbon conjecture says, well, so I guess you have to state it one way or the other. All slice knots are ribbon. Okay. So the question is, you know, can every knot in the three sphere that slice be put in a diagram that has only these nice types of ribbon singularities? Okay. And this is a very famous open conjecture that is pretty much wide open. I think it's hard to say one way or the other whether it's true or not. Now, one thing I will say is there's another way to rephrase this. So maybe I'll just draw a couple pictures to illustrate this. So here's what a ribbon. Here's what a slice disk might look like. So let's take a slice knot. I'll just make something up. Okay, here's our slice knot, K. What type of a disk could it bound? Well, it turns out that it can be fairly complicated. So I'll try to draw this in a nice way. Okay, so, you know, you need to remember that this is just a schematic. Okay, so what's going on in this picture? Good question, right? That is a disk, right? It really is. I mean, you could think about it. Just sort of push this blob down, push that blob up and down, and then push it all up there, and then push the other one up. It's really just a disk that you've sort of taken a disk here and then pushed your finger through it in funny ways. Okay? But it's got a key, there's a key fact here, which is that there's a local max. Okay? So when I say that a knot is slice, it means that it bounds a disk into the four ball. So this disk goes down to the four ball and does really weird things, and it might even have some local maximum. What does that mean? It means in our movie, we would actually have to introduce a new disk somewhere, you know, that comes out of the blue, gets entangled with a thing, and then somehow it unknots. Okay. So if you know anything about Morse functions, you know, this is like saying that we have an index 2 critical point if we're looking at the radial Morse function. So slice disks can do this. Okay. Ribbon disks can't do this. So if we have a ribbon knot, you know, well, we already have a... I mean, here's a nice picture of a ribbon knot already drawn. Let's stick with this one. I was just going to recreate it anyway. This is what a ribbon disk looks like, okay? It's, you know, it's a disk. It might split apart. It might tangle with itself. It might split lots more times, tangle even more. But there's no maxima. And you can see why. I mean, we don't need any maxima to push this into the four ball. So another way to rephrase this question is, can every slice disk be changed so that it has no local maxima? If you're given a slice disk that has a local maxima, can you change it into a disk that doesn't have a local maxima? And that's an equivalent way of rephrasing the slice ribbon conjecture. And this is extremely extremely intertwined with a lot of really hard questions in four-dimensional topology about the way things cannot in four-dimensional space and the different way that structures can be put on four manifolds. A lot of quite complicated things go into it. And it's a tough problem. Don't do it for an undergraduate thesis. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you. Do people usually go for an hour or 50 minutes or... I did 55, so I figured. I'm wrong either way, right? Okay. Okay. Well, if you have any questions, yes.
Can you repeat why this knot is not a slice knot?
Which one?
The you said no on the right. The right.
These guys?
Yeah, the one up. Yeah, this.
Oh, why it's not a ribbon knot? Yeah. Maybe I can draw it a little bit nicer. Let me get my tools.
Especially you said it was not a slice knot.
Yeah, what I mean is it's not a ribbon knot. Ribbon knots have to look like this. This is the only way they can intersect, and this is not extremely well drawn, but it's meant to not look like that. And so maybe I can kind of, you know, this sort of goes back behind there. So the point is that the intersection of these disks is sort of like an arc between two different components of the thing, where as this intersection is an arc that goes straight across.
What does it mean? Why is it so different?
Okay, well, here's one way that's different. If I cut along this arc, then I could easily just pull these apart. And so if we think about this thing as being oriented, it's going to be oriented like this. Okay. And this comes from the fact that, you know, if you have a band that's orientable, then the orientations on the boundary are going to be running in opposite directions. Uh-huh. And so what I can do is I can sort of do a banding move like this. Ooh. And then I can push them completely away. I can't do that here. These might be running, let's see, what might this be doing? This might be going like this, and this might be going like this. And if I, you know, if I were to somehow band those together, it's just going to be weird. You know, it's going to do something like this. That goes there. I don't even know what it's going to do. So I guess maybe I don't have anything extremely insightful to say about that, other than it just doesn't look. It's just not the right form. It could be slice. That could be part of a slice knot that somehow bounds a disk, but it's not in ribbon position. Okay. For example, I mean, here's the stevedore that's not in ribbon position, and there it is in ribbon position.
That would contradict the conjecture, huh? If it was sliced and not ribbon.
Yeah, it would. But you don't know what the rest of the knot looks like.
Right.
Fill in the rest, and you can be famous. Yeah, you're here.
Oh, sorry, I didn't see you, man.
You're looking that way.
So, like, you said that ribbon knots can never have those local maxima, right?
I mean, they can, but you can always get rid of them.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So one way to define a ribbon knot, which is equivalent to what I said, is that a ribbon knot is a knot which bounds a disc into the four ball that has no local maxima. And that's equivalent to saying that it's a knot that can be put in a position in S3 that bounds an immersed disc with only ribbon singularities. So those two things end up being the exact same. Okay.
Let's thank our speaker.
Thank you. Please come ask me more questions if you want.